Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
President Putin is failing in his brutal war of aggression.
A Western ally is providing all the support Ukraine needs as it leads the fight against Russian aggression. I speak with President Zelensky's chief foreign policy advisor, Igor Zhovka. And
we've just heard sniper fire overhead.
What it looks like inside the trenches, a special report from the front lines. Then,
if your heart is hurting, then it's kind of doing what it's supposed to do. And that's okay, you know, but pain and sadness are an ingredient of a full human life.
In his new book, A Heart That Works, comedian, actor Rob Delaney shares the greatest pain any parent could ever know. Also, with Our America, a photographic history, filmmaker Ken Burns celebrates the images that help shape his country and his work. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London, where today Ukraine's First Lady, Olena Zelenska, came to make her nation's case to the British Prime Minister and Parliament, appealing to them not to forget the tragedy facing her country this Christmas and comparing Ukraine's struggles to Britain's suffering during World War II.
We are fighting for justice, but justice, like victory, is not possible without allies. The president of Ukraine has suggested and announced our formula of peace. Next day, Russia responded with hundreds of the missiles. But just like in 1942, the replies of Nazis did not matter. We have to understand that together we can do it with you.
Meantime, across the channel in Europe, NATO foreign ministers are wrestling with how to supply Ukraine the weapons and equipment it needs to survive a harsh winter at war. Led by the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, pledging solidarity and $53 million to bolster the electrical systems. The ministers also added this. We condemn Russia's cruelty against Ukraine's civilian populations, such as forcible deportations, torture, and barbaric treatment of women, children, and persons in vulnerable situations. NATO may say that Putin is failing on the battlefield, but he is exacting a fierce revenge against civilian targets and on Bakhmut right now, a town in the eastern Donbass. Ukraine's foreign minister says that his country needs, quote, weapons faster, faster, and faster. So joining me now from Kyiv is President Zelensky's chief diplomatic advisor. Igor Zhovka, welcome back to the program. Can I ask you what I proposed at the beginning of this introduction? Is Ukraine getting the number of weapons that it needs for this winter at war?
We're certainly getting the number we need, but not in enough quantity, I would say, because it's definitely, obviously, more than in the beginning of this open war, but definitely less that we need in order to start the counteroffensive in each and every region of Ukrainian territory, which is currently occupied by Russia. Look what we did in the Kherson region. That's because we got enough MLRS, because you start with the ammunition, with the artillery fire when you're starting the counteroffensive. Then you go by manpower using the combat vehicles and tanks. Provided that we have enough weapon, we would have started each and every region counteroffensive, and we would near the victory even closer for us.
So for people watching from the outside, we see that, yes, Kherson was liberated, as you say, but the Russians, as you are all reporting, are shelling, as we hear from the Kherson officials, almost every settlement on the bank, you know, the Western Bank. So they're still doing that. And as I said, they're also assaulting Bakhmut, this town in Donbass, and you all are also putting a huge amount of men and materiel there. Why? What is the strategic significance of that town?
Let me react first on Kherson. They are reaching the city of Kherson because our MLRS is not that having that far range, that long range to hit them in the controlled areas, in the areas controlled by them. As far as Bakhmut is concerned, for us it's very simple. This is Ukrainian territory. We're taking control of it. They will not let any Russian soldiers go. Well, for them, it's probably they are dreaming of taking over the Bakhmut, and then they are dreaming, this is their constant dream since 24th of February, to conquer all the Donetsk region, which they are failing to do. I mean, they set for themselves deadlines. It was 1st of May, 1st of June. Now we almost have 1st of December. Not they even close they are to get all the territory of Donbass or all the territory of Lugansk. So we'll take, we will withdraw, we'll withstand the city, and we'll come back to all our territories.
So I don't know whether you agree with what the NATO Secretary General says, that Putin is failing on the battlefield, therefore he's attacking civilian targets. I'm just going to play this soundbite.
He is responding with more brutality, attacking gas infrastructure, power lines, and trying to deprive the Ukrainians of water, electricity, light, and heating. Therefore, we need to support Ukraine, because what we see is that President Putin is trying to use winter as a weapon of war.
So what will that look like, you know, a winter at war with this constant attack on the, you know, heat and the water and the light?
That's the reality we have, and I completely agree with Secretary General. That probably reminds me of tactic of a coward, you know. You cannot stand against well-equipped and well-trained. Your so-called second army of the world proves to be not even the 25th army of the world or whatever. So when you fail on the battlefield, you start to fight against civilians. You start to fight against critical infrastructure. You start to fight against kindergartens, children's playgrounds, museums, schools, and universities. So this is true, but his aim is to freeze us, because we are in the ahead of winter. The temperatures in Ukraine are falling under zero Celsius degree, and month by month, and now week by week, we experience severe, massive, simultaneous missile attacks over all the major cities of Ukraine. No longer safer place in Ukraine currently. This week, we expected again the new missile attacks against the critical infrastructure. Yes, to deprive us of heat, energy, and everything. But we are managing to repair. We experienced a blackout for several hours last week. Now, almost all the infrastructure is restored. We are ready to a new attacks, we will definitely survive.
So you say that, and we also hear that extra cars are being added to, like, the trains going to Kherson and other areas as you try to evacuate certain cities. Do you think Putin is getting what he wants if these towns are being evacuated for the winter?
No, this is his dream, you know, to fully evacuate all the towns and cities in Ukraine, maybe to fully evacuate, if not, you know, evaporate all Ukrainians somewhere, I don't know. It definitely depends on each and every person whether to evacuate or not, but probably for the armed forces of Russia, it will be much more easier to destroy the empty cities rather than the cities inhabited with the Ukrainians. I don't know. We will struggle. We will survive. Whether people are evacuated or not, our armed forces will control the territory of Ukraine and will regain the territory which is not under control yet.
Just going back to the military piece of this, the New York Times has reported that both sides, Ukraine and Russia, are burning through weaponry and ammunition at a pace, as they say, not seen since World War II, and that there is concern in NATO countries that Soviet-era weaponry and ammunition that you're being supplied a lot with is kind of running out, and they're scrambling to find enough ammunition to keep you able to defend your country. Is that something you've heard, and is that worrying to you, particularly with the foreign minister saying we need more, faster?
Well, I could add faster, yes. And I would say that, yes, I mean, it's obvious reason, way that the Soviet-type weapon is no longer produced, or almost no longer produced, probably produced in some minor quantities in Russia or in Belarus. The way out is very simple. You in NATO countries had a modern state-of-the-art new equipment, new weaponry, new ammunition. So Let's give it more to Ukraine. Let's give it more in good quantity and sophisticated. Ukrainian armed forces know how to operate this weapon. No one doubts now that we are mastering this new weaponry in a very speedy manner. So let's help Ukraine more and more and more, faster and faster, and together we'll definitely win. Mm-hmm.
And we understand that there's talk about more sophisticated air defense systems coming to you. But I wanted to finish by asking you about the grain deal, about Ukraine's ability to export, and about, you know, the food poverty. We saw a senior American official in Odessa recently. What is the status there?
Well, last Saturday, you might notice in the news that my president held the first international summit on food security, grain from Ukraine initiative. Very simple. We still have Ukrainian grain to be exported. We still have Ukrainian ports in the Black Sea open. And we still have the poorest countries in Africa continent or somewhere in the Asian continent. Still need grain, because what Russia is doing in the 21st century, at the same time, the same what she was doing in 20th century with Holodomor in Ukraine, Great Famine in Ukraine, which was celebrated, commemorated on Saturday. So that's why we want to deprive the world from the Great Famine, another terror act what Russia is doing as of now. So we asked the countries to donate, and more than 25 countries were present at this summit, offline or online, and having collected already almost 200 million US dollars in order to sell the ships with Ukrainian grain to the poorest countries of the world, and by this save the world from great famine.
Mm-hmm. Igor Zhovka, thank you so much for joining us from Kyiv with that update. Meantime, it is rare to get a look at the trench warfare that's underway. Correspondent Lindsay Hilsum traveled to Ukrainian forward positions around the strategic town of Krasnohorivka. That's near Donetsk. She spent a tense day with the troops there.
Not the Somme, but Donetsk. Not 1916, but now in the 21st century. Ukrainian soldiers trudging through the splashing mire of the trenches. This is how it will be all winter, through rain and sleet and snow, inches of territory lost and gained.
Enemy for 500 meters of our.
So the enemy is just 500 meters away?
Yes.
That's not very far?
Yeah.
Bit too close for comfort?
Yeah. Every soldier have his fighting place.
Vadim shows me a firing position.
With everyone. And fight.
And fight, yeah.
Yeah. If we have artillery fight for us, we have...
The soldiers rotate every 2.5 hours and at times get barely any sleep.
We have superpower.
You have super... What's your superpower?
I'm Ukrainian.
The commander leads us further into the warren. And tells us we have to run across a stretch of open ground left so tanks can pass between trenches. The trees have shed their leaves so there's no cover. We can hear outgoing machine gun fire. In the deepest part of the trench, it's always night.
How are
you? And even the shortest soldier has to bend down to avoid cracking his head. Yuri shows me the location of an observation point and where the machine gunner stands. The Ukrainians don't just want to push the Russians back, but also to get them to waste manpower and ammunition.
We have a machine gun with a large caliber, 12.7 millimeters. We take it out and they shut up even more quickly after we fire with that one.
By now, the outgoing fire was getting intense, and there was incoming too as we were trying to leave.
Cihan, Cihan.
We've just heard sniper fire overhead,
That was after all the outgoing from the Ukrainian machine guns. So we're just going to stay down here for a bit.
Passé.
Eyes on. He's just... Open fire with the machine gun from the left. Use the dushка. When I was walking, he was watching us. He's watching us now.
So we wait. Listening. The outgoing machine gun fire from the Ukrainians is aimed at suppressing the Russians so they don't fire back. But the problem is that as long as there's firing from this position, there could be firing coming into us. And that's why we're waiting here in this trench and not moving.
Three, two.
After a few minutes of quiet, it's time for us to run across the open ground to the other trench. All safe. And now, down into the safety of the soldiers' sleeping quarters, which are warm and cosy. A necessity, not a luxury, because they need to keep kit dry. And Vadim has a companion.
We have a friend. No.
Olyenka, the kitten, is just 2 months old.
She is a good warrior.
She's a good fighter.
Mouse.
Oh, she gets the mice.
Yeah, yes.
Do you have a problem with mice in the trench?
No, we our place in the field.
Yeah.
It's filled many mouse.
And so, and are your, do you have a wife? Vadim thinks of the Netherlands, where he worked before the war, and of his girlfriend, who's in the Czech Republic.
If we win, I stand in Ukraine, make a family.
Yes. You'll make your life here.
My children live in the freedom country.
Life in Ukraine will be tough this winter, and nowhere tougher than the trenches of Donetsk. The risk is only too clear. But Ukrainian soldiers know why they're fighting and what they must endure to win.
Next, a frank conversation on a topic Ukrainians know all too well, grief. Comedian Rob Delaney is best known for his, let's just say, ribald humor. But 4 years ago, while in London to make his acclaimed television series Catastrophe, Delaney suffered a catastrophe of his own. He lost his infant son Henry to brain cancer. Delaney shares that experience in a new book, A Heart That Works, published in the United States today, and I recently sat down with him to talk about how he and his family get through every day. Rob Delaney, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
I wanted to first ask you about the title of your book, A Heart That Works. What does that mean in this context?
Well, I should first say it's half a quote from a lyric by Juliana Hatfield, a singer-songwriter from Boston that I grew up listening to. And the full quote is, a heart that hurts is a heart that works.
Right.
And that's just sort of become my life philosophy as things have bounced along and I've experienced more pain just through being alive. So if your heart is hurting, then it's kind of doing what it's supposed to do. And that's okay, you know, but pain and sadness are an ingredient of a full human life, so.
You were the father of three boys.
Yeah.
Henry, your youngest at the time, died. You have since another son, and we'll talk about that. But, you know, I as we talk, I've just come from a funeral.
Okay.
And it was a funeral for an elderly gentleman whose life was well-lived and absolutely fantastic. But you had to say goodbye to a child who was barely 3 years old.
Yeah, not quite three.
And it just must be so awful for a parent to lose a child.
Yeah, I'm tempted
It's not the right way of life.
Yeah, I know. It's funny because, you know, there are television cameras. I feel compelled to say, like, yeah. However, you know, there's no however. It's yes, full stop, as we say here in the UK. It's terrible. It was terrible. It is terrible. You pull through in some ways, I think most of the time. And his death did not diminish my love for his brothers, whom he loved dearly, or his mother, who he was crazy about. So I have responsibilities to them. And he, you know, they look like him, and they loved him and held him just as much as I did, more, if they're, you know, his mom. So there's threads that pull you forward, but the pain is, you know, I was looking at pictures of him this morning, as I do most mornings, and I'd rather be looking at him.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Okay.
Him.
Yeah.
The actual person who was Henry.
Yeah. I mean, a lovely, sweet, generally calm, kind little fella before he got sick. He was very magnetic. I think he sensed that he was going to have to just draw us towards him because he was the third boy in rapid succession. And so he did that and just pulled us towards him. You know, he didn't like cry a lot or, you know, whatever. Some kids can be quite a tempest, but he didn't do that. And then he got sick, and then he really, after his surgery, when his drive to get better and still grow and do things with his peers, because he still had friends come visit him in the hospital and his older brothers, so he was very driven and curious. You know, he learned sign language very quickly because he couldn't speak because of a tracheostomy.
Yeah.
And so then he just became so he went from lovely to amazing, and then he died, yeah, right before he would have turned three.
You have written an incredible book. It's just so raw, and it's just so, everything is out there. And we're going to talk a little bit about some of what you've written. But first, I'd like you to read a passage. I believe it's on,
yeah.
We've chosen it, but it's
sure.
On page 9.
Why do I feel compelled to talk about it, to write about it, to disseminate information designed to make people feel something like what I feel, what my wife feels, what my other sons feel? Done properly, it will hurt them. Why do I want to hurt people? And I do. Did my son's death turn me into a monster? That's certainly possible. It doesn't sanctify you. Things get broken. Maybe it's because I write and perform for a living that I can't help but try to share or communicate the biggest, most seismic event that has happened to me. The truth is, despite the death of my son, I still love people. And I genuinely believe, whether it's true or not, that if people felt a fraction of what my family felt and still feels, they would know what this life and this world are really about.
And what is this life and this world about? What have you discovered?
Well, I certainly don't know everything, but I do know that the rug can be ripped out from under you in a way where your skull will be fractured, you will go temporarily blind, you will go mad, you'll try to fix it, and you won't be able to. I mean to say, pain, like I talked about, you know, when we were talking about the title of the book, is guaranteed, and that's not bad, to say it simply. The more you understand that that is going to find its way into your life, then you can sort of metabolize it and ultimately be happier, you know, more frequently if you accept the fact that, you know, these things can and will happen.
So I said that at the time you had three children.
Yeah.
Henry died.
Yeah.
Your two older boys were... You had really involved them. You
yeah.
didn't try to shield them, you and your mm-hmm. wife. They really were there, hugging him,
yeah.
playing with him, reading
yeah.
to him, just doing all the things brothers and siblings do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they were there even after he died. They
oh, yeah.
saw him
oh, yeah.
lying there in your bed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me about that. And, you know, most parents are like, oh, no, 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 no,
yeah.
no, we can't talk about it. We've got to shield the young people.
Yeah.
We don't talk about death. But Henry was right there. And yeah. You even told the workers to cool it next door.
I did. I called, and I'm nicer about it in the book. Yeah, I called. They were doing construction on a house next to ours. And we already didn't like them because they were doing it for years. I mean, get it done. Like, you got to work in your house, sure. But anyway, so I called them and I said, tell your guys to stop work on the house. My son died earlier this morning and we want to keep the windows open so that his body can stay cool. So tell him to quit or I'll go over there and do it myself. And he was like, okay. And yeah, we wanted to... I don't know, spend time with his body, you know? His spirit had left it, but that was a body that we had cared for, you know? And we had learned we'd become really good at, you know, emergency care for a child with an unsafe airway. So we knew a lot medically, you know? We would train people, you know, your average... staff nurse doesn't need to know how to do that. They can learn it. And of course, a lot of nurses do know how to do it, but they don't have to, you know, most doctors don't know how to do it. And so, yeah, I mean, the hours we put into all the maintenance of his tubes and various holes that they'd had to put in him and devices and stuff. So we didn't want to have him taken away right away. And yeah, our boys, his older brothers got right in there and cuddled with him. And I'm really glad we did that. Yeah. I'm really glad we did that.
Because you see the effect?
Yeah, it's real, you know, because it shocks you out of sort of a stunned state where you realize, yeah, he is dead, you know. I mean, I would have to repeat it to myself after they did take him away. I mean, for 6 months, I'd have to remind myself, you know, my son died. He got sick. We tried to find out what was wrong. It took a while. We found out what it was. It was terrible. It got worse. Then he died, and now he's dead. I mean, I would have to, because you don't believe, you can't believe it.
So it actually leads me to ask you to respond to something my own colleague Anderson Cooper has been doing, discussing his grief. His father died when he was 10 of a heart attack, apparently.
Okay.
And he was kept away. Kids were not allowed into the ICU at that time, right? Then his brother... when Anderson was 21, I believe, and the brother was 23, died by suicide, and his mother witnessed it. So I was asking him about this, and particularly about how... Anyway, this is what he told me in a recent interview.
Okay.
But my mom, you know, until the day she died, she would, out of the blue, say to me, you know, maybe if I had, you know, grabbed an iron from the fireplace and hit, you know, Carter... it would have knocked him out, and maybe that would have stopped him. You know, I could have stopped him and from going to the balcony. And so she, you know, she could never get to a place where she could accept the death, but she got to a place where she could continue to live. And sometimes you have to get to a place where you can live without a why. Yeah. And that's the way it is. I think for me, at least in the wake of my brother's suicide, getting to a place where I could live in a world where sometimes there isn't a why.
And he's been doing a podcast on grief and on all that he's lost and trying to understand it. Do you ever collide with the idea of a why?
No, I don't. And so that's really beautiful to me, what he said there. And that's why I have found our bereaved parents group that we go to so useful and spending time with other bereaved parents. But the reason that I find it so useful is because those people understand that there is no explanation. There are no words, right? That's why when people are like, you know, oh, well, what should I say? When someone, it doesn't matter what you say. Nothing you can say is going to make it better, offer any solace.
Which brings me to, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but that story that you tell of Rachel, who was one of Henry's carers.
Yeah.
And just describe her reaction.
Okay.
Because so many people, as you say, just don't know how to write, or they try to kind of calm you or calm themselves or try, you know, stay away from the rawness of it.
Right.
But Rachel. Whew.
Yeah. So Henry, because he had had an unsafe airway, normally he was all right as he went through the day, but in an instant it could become fatally, you know, blocked with anything. He's very young. He can't fix his own tracheotomy. So he could never be unattended, even in sleep. So he had night carers,
because we had to sleep for some portion of the day so we could take care of him during the day and his other kids. So, and you know, I should say, in London, because people who are watching this in America, that was provided by social care, yep. by our council.
NHS, right?
Yeah, by the
NHS. By your council, yes.
Not by the NHS, but working in tandem mm-hmm. with the mm-hmm. NHS.
Which doesn't happen in the United States.
Right. And so anyway, Rachel, one of his night carers, who was on duty the night that we found out his tumor had returned and he was going to die. And I told her, I said, listen, Rachel, I need to let you know that we went to the hospital today and got the results of Henry's last MRI, and his tumor has returned. Let that sink in. What can they do? Or what are they going to do? There isn't anything they can do. He's going to die. And she just started screaming, oh, Jesus Christ, no. Oh, God, no. And again and again, and, you know, like, shuffling around and in like shock. And I was just like, oh my God, let this be the template for how people talk to me when they hear that my son is going to die. That's the right response. Mm-hmm. That I was like, yes, correct. That's exactly, that's how it feels. That's what's going to happen. That's the response. So, you know, it's funny because, you know, British people will always be like, oh, well, we're so terrible at, you know, expressing emotion and, you know, no worse than Americans, you know, mm-hmm. same deal where people are like, oh, what do I say? What do I do? And, oh, I'm so, oh, your tragedy or like, oh, the, and I'm like, shut up, you know, start screaming. Let's scream.
We talked about the social care that your council mm-hmm. provided.
Yeah.
And the NHS here is famous for its brilliant medical care that's yeah. basically free for people, yeah. unlike in the United States where you'd get bankrupted,
yeah.
you know, with any kind of serious illness.
Right. So being, you know, a public figure, I do take advantage of the opportunity to talk about the NHS a lot because it's quite staggering to discover the NHS in your mid-30s, which I was when we moved here. And the wonderful thing about the NHS with Henry's illness is the gift of time that it gave us. Because I wasn't on the phone with some insurance functionary in an office tower in St. Louis, I was by his bedside, holding his hand, shaking a little candy thing filled with lentils to try and find the Lego guys in it. In the United States, I would have been saying, please approve this MRI, or, hey, I just went to the pharmacy and they wanted $600 for this thing because mm-hmm. my prescription plan in the middle of the night was sold to another provider and they screwed up my login information. So the amount of clerical and administrative work that you have to do when you get sick, not to mention the bills, of yep. course, which suicide because of medical debt is a thing that happens in the United States, right? So that's one nightmare. But in addition to the financial nightmare, we got the gift of time that the NHS gave us. So I am a staunch defender of the NHS and will be until I die, maybe in an NHS bed.
Something extraordinary, and I said we'll get to your fourth child in a moment, because you did have a fourth child, Teddy.
Yeah.
And he was born just after Henry died.
6 months.
Several months after Henry died, which means that your wife was pregnant while Henry was dying.
Yeah.
And you write about that. And you write about how the grief caused you to cling to each other so much that you also expressed love, physical love.
Oh, yeah.
And
some
people might think that's weird, having sex in the middle of this grief.
No, I mean, look. I mean, in fact, my wife was massively helpful with this book. She read draft after draft and remembered things correctly, whereas she was like, yeah, that didn't happen. Mm-hmm. That happened then, you know, or actually it was this person. So super helpful. And she's also a voracious reader, so she's good with stories. So very helpful. But at one point, just in a first draft, I mentioned that we got a hotel room a few doors down from the hospital when he was having his 14-hour surgery to remove the tumor. And yes, we had sex. And like being grilled before Congress. So you had sex with your wife? I did. I had sex with my wife. And I put that in just because I wanted to be totally honest. First draft, you vomit it out. And then I said, like, you know, and I can take that out. And she was like, no, don't take that out. People should know that part of the crazy is that could happen. You're scared. You're close. you're married. You know, you watch, you've already watched three Big Bang Theories on the hotel TV. You have sex. And so, anyway, but what's funny is a lot of bereaved parents or hospital parents have been like, hey, thanks for putting that in because, you know, we actually did that too. And so, yes, it's even in grief, it's okay to have sex. But I should say, it was 6 months after he was born, so it was, it wasn't after he died that Leah got pregnant. And so, at Henry's memorial, I knew she was pregnant, but nobody else did except Henry. Henry knew. We told him. You know, before the 12 weeks where you like start telling people, we told Henry that he was going to be a big brother. And so he was the first to know.
Yeah. That's a good place to end.
Yeah, okay.
Rob Delaney, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our next guest is one of America's most important documentary filmmakers. And it turns out that grief is also an influence in his life. He is Ken Burns, who's won every major award for his many series on historical events and figures, as well as on social issues. But his latest work uses the medium of still photography. His new book, Our America, A Photographic History, collates images which charts the nation over nearly 200 years, as he now discusses with Walter Isaacson.
Thank you, Christian, and Ken Burns, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Walter. Happy holidays.
This is an amazing book. I mean, it's just a great series of photographs, and it begins with your father. Tell me about your father's influence on it.
Yeah, it's huge. It's dedicated to him. He was a cultural anthropologist, but an amateur photographer. And my very first memory, 2.5, 3 years old, was sort of snaking myself through the stud walls of a soon-to-be-completed darkroom that he was building in our basement in a track house in a development in Newark, Delaware, where he was the only anthropologist in the entire state. And then a second later, the next memory is of sitting in his strong left arm as his right arms manipulated the tongs and the smells and the eerie light and watch that magic, still to me, magic of a blank sheet of paper suddenly becoming an image. And, you know, I was hooked, and the still image is still, as a filmmaker, the building block, the DNA of what we do.
You talk about the influence of your father, but of course your mother was a great influence in your life and in some ways part of your soul. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I don't think we'd be talking, Walter. I don't think we'd know each other if she hadn't lived and died. She got cancer very, very early in my life, 2 or 3 years old. It was something that my younger brother Rick and I saw and witnessed. It was devastating. We didn't have a childhood. She died just a few months short of my 12th birthday when I was 11. A very heroic struggle, one of the most brave human beings I've ever met. And so a good deal of what I do for a living, as my late father-in-law said to me when I said I couldn't remember the day that she died, it was always approaching, it was always receding. He said, well, I bet you blew out your candles on your birthday cake as a kid, wishing she'd come back. And I said, yeah, how did you know? And he goes, look what you do for a living. And I said, excuse me? He said, you wake the dead. You make Abraham Lincoln and Louis Armstrong come alive. Who do you think you're really going, trying to wake up? And of course, it's her. And so she is ever present in my life. There is not a day. And as you know, the half-life of grief is endless. And yet what we do with it, the difficulties and the traumas, is we negotiate. Art is the negotiation of the fact that none of us get out of here alive. And so I think my own work has been, in a way, a response to that trauma and a way to make lemonade out of the lemons I was handed as a little boy.
One of your other inspirations and mentors was Jerome Liebling, right? And I think it's the cover of the book, this
yes.
wonderful picture on the cover. Tell me about him and why you chose this as a cover picture.
Yeah, so when I watched my dad cry after my mom died when I was 12, and he'd never cried before, not when she was sick, not when she died, not at the very sad funeral, but he cried at an old movie that he let me stay up and watch. And I thought, I'm going to be a filmmaker. I'm going to be a filmmaker. I'm going to be, you know, Alfred Hitchcock or John Ford or Howard Hawks. But I ended up going to Hampshire College, a new, brand new experimental college in Amherst, Massachusetts. Massachusetts, and fell under the sway of two social documentary still photographers, Elaine Mays and Jerome Liebling, her senior. And he just gave me everything. He rearranged my molecules. He would say, go see, do, be, engage in all of these things. And you know, I graduated in 75. He died in 2011. And there wasn't a moment when he wasn't my mentor still to that day. And even now, he feels very much a part of my life. And so there was no other photograph but his own to grace the cover, which is, I was asked by someone in an interview recently, what's the most important person, you know, photograph in the book? And I said, oh, please, maybe it's the 1865 photograph of Abraham Lincoln, the last photograph where he's holding the glasses. You just see the whole history of us in him. And I said, but equally important is this little kid on a street corner in New York City in 1949, with his improbable hot hockey shirt, these untied, you know, shoes, shorts, a kind of wary thing, a little fedora on his hat. He's holding his coat in front of a big sweeping arch of a bumper, a wheel hub of an old car from 1940s. And to me, if the book exists in a space, it's in the very minimal space between Abraham Lincoln and this kid, and the huge space between it. And it is a testament to the extraordinary vision and eye of Jerome Liebling that I am also here.
Your documentaries deal fundamentally at times with race, whether it's the Civil War or jazz or baseball. And this book does the same, from the cover photo to the very end. Tell me about why race is such an important part of the narratives.
You know, I don't know where to begin. I can count on the fingers of one hand and still have a couple fingers left. The films that I've done out of the 40 or so that have been on PBS that don't deal with race, because you cannot do a deep and responsible dive into American history without running up against this fundamental contradiction. We know exactly where we were born and when, and we know what our catechism is. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. The guy who wrote that owned hundreds of human beings in his lifetime. And so we have in our own collective memory a group of people who have had the peculiar experience of being unfree in a free land. And that has been the source of so much pain and so much tragedy in the history. And it's also been the source of so much joy and so much positive investment. Louis Armstrong alone helps to balance the scales of injustice with his extraordinary art. But it's all there in front of us. So you can't help but do it. I mean, the main thing about us, Walter, is freedom, you know, and the tension in that, like what I want, personal freedom versus collective freedom, what we need. And they're often at loggerheads. And I think the book, without consciously or didactically or pedagogically saying it, you see that dynamic in it. You see the majesty of our beautiful continent that we inherited. You see the tragedy of the dispossession of the native peoples. You see all of those tensions. But I think underlying so many is what historians, my goodness, I'm an amateur one, would call our original sin, which is the original sin of tolerating chattel slavery, just as we are proclaiming to the world a new form of government that was going to be based on the principles of the Enlightenment and the equality of all human beings.
You titled the book Our America, and the pictures show the great diversity of our America. But the title also implies that there are things that we share.
Yeah.
Tell me what that you're trying to show that we share.
Well, I think, Walter, everybody's talking about, oh, we can't teach our kids the sad stuff. We can't do this. We can't do that. We can't talk about this. And I just realized these are the hallmarks of a tilt towards a kind of an authoritarianism in which you suddenly take, the nationalist approach, which is, all human beings do horrible things, every culture, everywhere. It's a litany. What you want to do is say, let's own it all. the hallmark of a great country is to embrace its diversity and understand that in the case of the human resource of it, that diversity has been a strength. As Pete Hamill said, that's an alloy, much stronger than its constituent parts. And at the same time, we can know that the ongoing struggle for freedom has always been complicated and is ongoing. And the fragility of that republic that Franklin thought that, you know, would be, you know, if you can keep it, goes along for 250 years almost. And yet now the things we've taken for granted through the first crises, the Civil War, the Depression, the Second World War, you know, of free and fair elections, of the peaceful transfer of power, of an independent judiciary, now all seem kind of up for grabs. And we've kind of can sense the tenuousness. You know, we've been through this stuff before. We'll go through it again. We just have to periodically re-remind ourselves of that complexity, and let's celebrate that complexity. As I say in the introduction, it's our America, an attempt to gather the sense of us in the U.S., but it's also my America, right? It's just my attempt to say, this is what I've learned. Every 50 state is represented here. Nearly every project we've ever worked on is there, but not didactically. There are people playing, you know, having a tug of war in downtown Putney, if you can call it downtown Putney, Vermont. There's a beautiful gal from my little village in New Hampshire. There's girls dancing on the beach in what must have been risque, but seems to us completely covering their body, swimsuits in Jamestown, Rhode Island. You know, there's a kid with, you know, a six shooter, you know, toy gun playing. They're native peoples. There's celebration and dance and music and art and life. But there's all the other things that we are also too. And you don't stay great if you think you're going to paint a sanitized Madison Avenue version of yourself. It ain't going to happen. So our history is checkered, but there is no one on earth whose history is checkered. Just beware the people who sell you that Madison Avenue, treacly, white picket fence, morning in America, have missed the story of us, which has been my beat. And this is just another form of exploring it.
I was struck by the picture of the Fuji Athletic Club.
Yeah.
And it was not just the interesting picture. This is a case where I went to the back and read all about it. So sometimes it helps to know the backstory, too.
Yeah, well, this is what I think is that, you know, it really requires two passes. One, let the photograph work on you. And then you can keep your fingers and go back and forth. Because in the case of that, a late 19th century photograph of a Japanese-American baseball team in the United States. Well, you know, this is part of the adoption of our national pastime. What you don't know is that the guy in the lower right-hand corner is a man named Chiro Obata. Chiro Obata will become a really well-respected painter, but he will also be, at the beginning of the Second World War, interned in an internment camp and will have to struggle as an artist. So this film, you know, straddles our baseball series, and it straddles our film on the national parks, and it straddles other things that have dealt World War II, that have dealt with Japanese internment. But he becomes a great champion of the national parks, and then uses the strengths of the redwoods and the sequoias to permit him to figure out how to negotiate the indignity of him, an American citizen, having to be interned for the duration of the war in one of the most scandalous things that we've done in our long and at times sordid history.
I think the only person who appears twice in the book is Abraham Lincoln. First, the amazing picture of him at the end of his life, and then him as the Lincoln Memorial. And both of those pictures talk about what you talk about, the struggle for freedom, the march to freedom, democracy, if we can keep it.
If we can keep it. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, there's another one just a few pages after that picture, that beautiful picture in early 65, the last picture, portrait of him that's so beautiful and so famous. And Everything is etched. Everything we've been through and everything we're going to go through is etched in his face.
The story of America seems, and the fight for freedom all seems etched in Lincoln's face
It's all there. And he's able to capture us in, as we know, the best language that any president has used. He's also, a few pages later, they're burying him in Springfield, Illinois, in a soft spring rain, because sometimes when you're at the crux of these American questions, violence often comes, and violence is a byproduct. But there he is, enshrined in the most beautiful of all memorials of all time, the Lincoln Memorial, and you're up behind him, and he's listening, because what's happening, and you don't know this, it just says Washington, D.C., 1963. It doesn't say August 28th, 1963. Somebody said, oh, that's Dr. King's March on Washington. No, you can find that in the back matter. You're looking at Lincoln watching something take place over his shoulder. You're with him still. He lives still in the hearts of all of us, as the dedication says, and the nation that he saved. And out there is Dr. King, re-upping, you know, if Jefferson is the 1.0 and the Gettysburg Address and Lincoln's total body of action is the 2.0, then King is saying the 3.0. He's coming to collect the promissory note, but he's also got a positive vision of where we can go. And in fits and starts, we've gone there, we've taken steps backwards, we sort of feel things retrenching now, but, you know, we'll push forward. And I hope that the book is seen as not dark, but as hopeful. In that way.
Another part of the march and fight for freedom in America and the struggles has been for women. And there's a juxtaposition of pictures in the book, or two pictures in the book that struck me. One is, I think, Jamestown Beach, the girls dancing on the beach. And then a very iconic photograph of Susan B. Anthony.
Yeah.
Tell me how those play off each other.
I love the severity of Susan B. Anthony. She is the sort of walking face of the movement that she and Elizabeth Cady Stanton sort of started back in 1848 with the Seneca Falls Convention. And their language is what will eventually, long after their death, 15 years after their deaths or so, will be enshrined as the amendment giving women the right to vote. 144 years, Walter, after the Declaration of Independence, more than half of our population finally gets partially some rights in it. But also we have to remember there's the irony of a black slave, enslaved woman holding a white baby. You would trust your most precious thing, but you can't extend to those people who take care of your most precious thing anything other than enslavement. That's where the contradiction goes.
Early in the book, you have the photograph of the U.S. Capitol. It's 1846, it says. Did you think of ending the book with a picture of the Capitol under siege in 2021, or would that have somehow warped what you were trying to say in the book?
I think it would have warped in every sense of that word, Walter. I mean, as I said, you know, we're in the history business, and it means that we sort of treat the near present with a kind of impressionistic arm's length. We wouldn't want to go up to the very present, because it then becomes a priori didactic and binary. And what you want to do is begin to understand that this, you know, world we live in, both a media culture, good, bad, red state, blue state, or the computer world that dominates everything, whether we're aware of it or not, a one or a zero, isn't actually what anything that human life is about. It can't not produce a Leonardo da Vinci. It cannot produce a Benjamin Franklin or a George Washington or, you know, a Ruby Bridges or, you know, Emmett Till's mom. You know, there's something else going on, and I want to know about that something else, and I don't want to be distracted by that. In a book like this, it's our story, and I want to keep as many of our brothers and sisters engaged in this story as possible.
Ken Barnes, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And what a wonderful romp through 200 years of history. Finally tonight, a match like no other, this World Cup of controversies. When Iran and the USA played at the 1998 tournament in France, it was and still is described as the most politically charged match in World Cup history. But in an example of the power of sport, the Iranians handed the Americans back then white roses before the game, and both teams joined in a team photo. Iran won 2-1 then. Now, their first rematch, once again overshadowed by politics. Sources tell CNN that Iranian players are being threatened that their families will face violence and torture if they refuse to sing the national anthem again or join any protests against the regime. That is it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.